Welcome, everyone. Erev Tov. Good evening. It's really special to have all of you here tonight. In just a few moments, we're going to be introducing George. But first, we did want to say a couple of words about our experience that we had in the South.
We had this wonderful, wonderful adventure, pilgrimage, really, to be able to go to the South and learn the lessons of those who've come before us, who've marched and seen things change, and see things change again, and continued to march. And so really, we started talking about this several years ago, and it finally came to fruition this past summer. 45 Sparkers and Etsniks traveled together, and our tour guide was the amazing George Shinhoster, who is with us all this evening. Yay! One of our concepts early on, as Chaim and I sort of conceived of this trip, was we didn't want it just to live only in the lives of the people who were able to go to the South, but to come back and for all of us to bring our experiences back to you all so that we could continue marching together. For those of us who went to SUFS last weekend or whenever that was, we're going to keep marching, yes? So we wanted to share with you just a very short highlight film of our time together.
And one thing that was very important on the trip, which is something that's very important to both communities, is the power of music. The power of music, the power of song. And, of course, it was song and music that was so instrumental at keeping the marching going and keeping faith and keeping hope alive, even during those hard times, whether it was in prison or when on the marches when they were being turned back. It was the power of song, the power of music that kept us moving forward. And that was something that really brought us together, both the Sparkers and the Etsniks, as two communities that love music and singing. We had a songbook, so whether it was on the bus or just walking across the Selma Bridge, there were many moments that were punctuated with music. And you're going to hear some of those moments and the music here in the video. So enjoy.
We shall overcome someday.
Hey!
once again, a huge thank you to Kevin, who during the whole tour, I had no idea what he was doing. Now I understand. Now I understand. Amazing job, Kevin. Thank you so much.
And also to all of the Surgic leadership and all of the Etsniks and Sparkers who've collected and shared pictures. And you all have created like a 50-plus page memory and itinerary of all that we did with notes and everything. It's incredible. So for those of you who were able to go and learn the lessons and document and share the stories, would you just raise your hand so others in the room can see that you've gone for that witness? And so if you have a question about the trip, turn and ask somebody, anyone here with their hand raised. They would love to share with you what's been meaningful. To represent both communities, we would like to at least invite two of you that we have asked them in advance. They know this is happening. To come up and share a highlight or some meaning of what the trip meant for them. So Jana, could we invite you to come up? Sure, you may come first if you like. Jana has been a wonderful, incredible leader in our Surgic group, our Spark Ets Racial Justice Impact Coalition, and we're deeply grateful for your friendship and partnership. I'm grateful.
I'm grateful for having this group, and grateful for the trip, and grateful for the opportunity to try and tell people about it. Can't do much better than that video, though. But I wanted, and it was really hard to figure out what to talk about tonight when Pastor Daniel asked me. I hadn't written a report on what I did on my summer vacation for a really long time. So this was, you know, this was an experience. But there were three things I wanted to, that I really have been thinking a lot about that I brought back with me and I wanted to share with you tonight. And the first was just the trip. I knew my history, right? I knew slavery. I knew Jim Crow. I knew all of those things. But the trip really brought it to me in a very visceral way, and you saw some of that up there. But there were three things that really I wanted to highlight. The first was the Equal Justice Initiative Museum, which touched so many of us and just brought you through the history of chattel slavery through to today, and made you really feel through all kinds of amazing presentations and ways of capturing history how deeply embedded that system was and how long it went on. You saw the pictures from the Lynching Museum, which was a second museum that was in Montgomery and incredibly impactful. That was where there were the bronze slabs hanging down, and each one represented a county in the South and the names on the county of people who had been lynched there and the dates. And just knowing that each one represented an individual horror, some of which were also captured in separate story vignettes, but that was incredibly impactful. And the third was meeting Dr. Linda and just understanding the violence. Linda Lowry, Blackman Lowry, she was 14 when she was brutally beaten on trying to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And even now, I believe she's about 80, just brings tears to her eyes when she talks about the face of the man who cuddled her in the head when she was 14, sending her to the hospital with 35 stitches. So all that sounds pretty depressing, right? And maybe, you know, maybe the Trumpites are right and we should just forget about history because it makes us feel bad. But no, that wasn't my experience. My experience was that understanding the magnitude of the horrors and the length of time just made me appreciate, it made me all the more inspired by the people who made change and who stood up to those things. So that leads me to my second takeaway from the trip. I came back from the trip understanding that I had to stop being such a wimp when it came to working for social change and fighting authoritarianism. We learned things about so many campaigns, and it was hard. I had versions of this where I talked about things that I'd learned, but realizing that, you know, it took individuals of courage, but also individuals doing the work. Everything from running off leaflets to making peanut butter sandwiches from the people who were marching from Selma to Montgomery over the course of three rainy days. It took all of that footwork, and all of that footwork was done in the face of not knowing how things were going to turn out and in the face of the potential for incredible violence and harm. So while I might find speaking up scary, and I do find it scary to be up here, and I may find like walking on the sidewalk with a sign a little bit embarrassing, I have no excuse. The truth is that to fight segregation, ordinary people faced violence that I can barely conceive of, and that I'm really not likely to face as a middle-aged white woman in this society. They confronted powerful embedded systems that were much more gruesome than MAGA is today. I try to hold that inspiration close as we see immigrant neighbors disappeared, voting rights clawed back, and people in Gaza bombed and starved. So that takes me to takeaway three. And this last point may surprise you. I came back from the trip with a profound sense of optimism that change is possible, not to mention a profound appreciation for how much change has occurred. Ending slavery after hundreds of years was overwhelmingly difficult and meaningful, even though the reaction was decades of segregation and lynching. The enactment of civil rights laws and norms was overwhelmingly difficult and meaningful, even though structural racism in the American caste system means that there's still massive injustice. The racial reckoning of 2020, which brought a lot of us together in the first place to start working on these issues here, was meaningful, even though the reaction has been whatever we have now in Washington. There's lots of bad stuff happening. I am not naive. But still, for those of us who are the descendants of immigrants and the descendants of slaves, I keep thinking of the phrase, I am my ancestors' wildest dreams. And that tangible awareness of change was brought home to me by being in the South. I'd never been there before. I'd never been further south than Washington, D.C., and I was a little nervous about it. But from the moment I got there and found black people and white people sharing the same spaces almost everywhere we went, that's a change that's happened in my lifetime. I felt it when we were in the park in Montgomery. We had Hafdallah service, much like we had tonight. And we were out there in the open, and we were black people and white people, and we were singing Hebrew, and we were lighting candles, and we were there in the open in a place that had been a site of so much darkness. And so all that gives me hope and optimism, and that's what I brought back from the Civil Rights trip. Thank you.
Yasher Koch, that was beautiful. Thank you so much. And Pastor Mark Arevalo, and have you come up and share.
So also like Jenna, I'm basically going to repeat everything Jenna said, just the themes, but like the stories were a little different. Let me start with the best part of my trip. My own chavara of sorts got expanded. I've been attending events and working in this building for over a decade. But outside of Rabbi Chaim, Ellen, Jenna, and Sherry, I haven't actually had a lot of conversation with ethnics. And I had lots of wonderful conversations on this trip and learned about their lives, from chatting with David over two consecutive breakfasts to hanging out with Gail. Where's Gail? Hanging out with Gail on the back, on the top of a paddle boat going up and down the Mississippi at night. And so, and then there was, of course, my James. James, my brother and roommate. And was, of course, my introvert part was also met by Mr. George here, because we sat and watched Game 7 of the NBA Finals in a hotel room in Birmingham in dead silence. It was beautiful. So thank you, George, for that. Well, not dead silence, but yeah, sorry, pretty much. And I'm very grateful to my wife, Stacey, who's actually in the back with the kids, and also to Danielle for encouraging me to go on this trip. So with so many people trapped with me for a couple of weeks, I decided to ask questions that I usually ask whenever I'm trying to do icebreakers and stuff like that. But my questions were, what should America look like? And specifically, what should the American melting pot look like? And given all that our country has felt in the last couple of weeks, months, especially at the federal level, it seemed like an apropos question. And I got lots of responses from, I like to use the term stew, not pot, to, I actually don't think it exists. And at least two people on the trip pointed out that the first use of the term American melting pot was by a Jewish American playwright who was critiquing assimilation in the United States at the turn of the century. So I learned a lot in these conversations. And those conversations enriched my experience in ways I didn't think was possible. But there's a reason why we packed up and traveled over 2,000 miles from home. It's because geography is important. Place is important. So back there, we spent a few days in Montgomery, the capital of Alabama. I had actually been there a couple years before, and if you were on the trip, you know what I'm about to say. So one piece of geography captured my attention. This is the Court Square Fountain. And as you in the background, you can kind of see that's the state capitol up there. And so it goes down this street, Dexter Street, and then it curves off to the right to Market Street. So here's another picture of what it looks like. There's location. So imagine this is the Alabama River right here, okay? So there's a dock right here. You have Market Street that goes over to here. Court Fountain, that thing is right here. And then you have Dexter Street going along here with all these buildings that have just been there for hundreds of years. Very, very long time. At the very end of Dexter Street is the State Capitol building. And also, right here where Ellen is Dexter Street Baptist Church, which is where Martin Luther King preached. And right over here is the Confederate White House. So this is all in line. And so I became very angry when I realized what was being covered up. So this is a picture of what it looked like in 1865. You can see that Commerce Street right here, this was actually the drop-off spot for enslaved people to be brought to the auction block, which was the fountain. And then all along the sides, you had slave depots, storage spaces. You had banks where people were taking out loans to buy people. And Dexter Street Baptist Church, if you look at that map, was actually a slave pen at that time. And so I was angry every time I thought about this. Every time we drove past it, people would see me either raging or crying because I kept thinking about this experience and what was being covered up. And I thought, do you think you can get away with this? Just by covering, like putting this wrought iron thing here that people would forget somehow? There were markers there, but 15 years before, there was no mention of what had happened there. It was all, this was built in 1885, and this is for this purpose and that purpose, but there was nothing about what this actual purpose of Market Street and Commerce Street, not Dexter Street, Commerce Street, what it was all for. So anger can make you pretty myopic, so I kind of got locked into this rage. But then I did something very, very simple. One night, I sat outside our hotel, which is a couple of blocks from the fountain, and I people watched. And I saw groups of people going to restaurants, to parties, to gatherings. For the most part, the groups were either all white or all black. But there they were, talking, having fun, goofing around, and I thought, there's all this terrible history around us. How do you not see this? How do you not feel this right now? How does it affect your day to day? I even saw a bride and a groom enter our hotel after the wedding. A black groom and a white bride, by the way. And I thought, how is this not affecting you right now? Like it's affecting me. And there's a response being Wick. It's because they're normal. They're human. They live here. It's part of who they are, all of this. They can't live in the past. They have to move on, and no matter how ugly history was and how it still affects them, they have to keep going. And it's complicated. How do you feel gratitude towards the country that provides opportunities and also feel the same indignation towards that country that dismisses you and your loved ones? And then I thought, well, what are the Court Street fountains that I see every day that cover up once was here but was taken away? Our Bay Area neighborhoods are in large part built upon socioeconomic and economic boundaries. There's black redlining going on in our place. The neighborhood I grew up in South City, in my childhood home, it was actually under a covenant where white homeowners could only sell to whites, and I didn't know that until I had moved out of that place. And if you go back further, all the way back to Spanish colonization of California and the treatment of the Ohlone peoples in the Bay Area, which Bob gratefully pointed out. So with all of this, and I'm just ranting right now, but with all of this, I kind of arrived where I am today, which is we can't live in the past. Yes, there are injustices from then that do need to be reconciled, and there are new injustices that are taking place right now that we have to address. We do live our lives. We're normal. But we also have to face the inconvenient truths of our society, because hiding isn't a real option. And where's Miss Lenore? Well, there she is. Could you please stand up for a second? Sorry. So at the Civil Rights Memorial Center, which is a block away from MLK's old church and a block away from the Confederate White House, the theme is the march continues. And God calls us to take part in God's work of tikkun olam, of repairing the world. As someone on the trip quoted, and as there's a poster in the copy room that I see all the time that says this, while we do not have to finish the work, we cannot ignore it either.
Thank you so much, Pastor Mark. And with that, will you all join me in welcoming up our dear brother and friend and example and leader and disciple maker, George Schinhoster.
Forced upon me, can't refuse it, didn't seek it, didn't choose it. Suffer if I abuse it, give account if I lose it. A tiny minute with an eternity in it. Dr. Benjamin Mays. Good afternoon. You know, every time somebody introduces me, I have to pinch myself to see who's really there. Because when they do it and when I do it very different. I like to say, how can I say thanks for the things you do for me, Lord? Things so undeserved that you do to prove your love for me. The voices of a million angels could not express my gratitude for all I am and all I hope to be. I owe it all to thee. To God be the glory. You know, I've been here 2 days. Feels like I've been here a week. I ate when I got off the plane. I ate when Gary and Pam picked me up. I ate before they took me back to the hotel. I ate when I got to the room. I met Kwame this morning along with some others, and I ate again. Then I had that spaghetti. So I've been eating my way through Palo Alto. I talked to the rabbi, and I wanted to express one of those meals for those of you who have no idea of that rich delicacy of oxtails. I want to let you know that coconuts has some of the best I've ever tasted, and the cornbread that went with them set me up so that I was going to be able to have the energy to continue to stand with you tonight. But I'm going to sleep after all this is over. I wanted just to, I was sitting here listening at takeaways. And you know, as I talked to the group, I don't have but one story to tell. So if you heard it once, you're going to hear it again. And you're going to hear that part of it that you didn't hear. I'll try to add to it and keep you there. But I had the opportunity of a lifetime. I grew up the third of 6 children. I had the opportunity of sleeping every night with 2 brothers in what is not a queen-size bed. That was a room for the boys. The girls had the other. I learned, my wife told me as we got married, why do you always sleep in that same spot? When you sleep with 2 brothers for 17 years, you learn to stay there. Somebody will let you get off of me, move over. It was a time that I learned the importance of family. It was the time that I learned what it meant to be a part of a village. It there was a time that learned or helped me to learn what I could be, gave me the confidence at least to try. And so my experiences in that little house in Savannah, Georgia, helped me to become who I am today. My mother would remind us on a regular basis that you could do all things through Christ who strengthens you. I believed I could fly. I didn't try it, but I believed it. Because there was always that opportunity that the only thing that would separate me was a bad try. You got to get in the game. You have got to try. Now I want to tell you all about another part of my career, the little digression. I'm not the best swimmer in the world, but I'm one of the best swimming teachers. Then they finally told me, you have to get in the water to teach swimming. You've got to be joking. But I could teach swimming without getting into the water. And so I tried those things. I believed that I could do. The summer of 1963, Savannah, Georgia. For those of you who here are as old or in my vintage, I want you to think about things that we saw on the tour before we reached 1962. I want you to begin to go back a few years earlier. I want to cite just a few things that began to prompt me to become who I am. 1955, Emmett Till was murdered, beaten, thrown into a river under dirt. Months after Emmett Till, we all forget Emmett Till, and I brought him up for a reason. A few months later, Rosa Parks sat down on a bus, and Rosa Parks sat down on a bus that she had ridden for years and decided enough is enough. Rosa Parks sat there, and when Rosa Parks sat down, it created something that was very, very, very tumultuous. For the next 380 days, no black person rode the buses in Montgomery, Alabama. And now when you don't know the significance of that, all these people who had gone from the brutalities that had existed for a century, for a century, throughout the South to people of color, these people decided to stand up in such a way that they brought down the whole city of Montgomery, Alabama. But not only did it bring down Montgomery, it spread out. But let me tell you how that happened. Rosa Parks went to jail on a Thursday night. She had a friend by the name of Joanne Robinson, who worked at Alabama State University, an HBCU. Now, for those of us who are vintage, we remember this machine called the Gestetner. I was talking to Pastor Danielle, and she said, oh, we can do that. We can print off all of this stuff. You can send it to me. I'm going to try to have it to you by the third. She said, oh, you could have it by Friday night. A Gestetner machine, you have to stand there and roll that jewel off. And you roll, and you roll. That muscle hurts now just even thinking about it. But what they did in that short time is roll off more than 50,000 flyers. By Sunday morning, they were on every black church's door. Black people throughout the county, without social media, without very many telephones, without very many telegraphs. And then I used to get chided for saying they told a woman. And that woman was the impetus to make Rosa Parks who she is. My deep underlying subject matter is the power of individual ordinary people. These were ordinary people who had had enough. Joanne Robinson took the movement. Then she gathered them preachers together. And they began to buy into that whole process. And for all of those days, nobody did anything outside of the norm. White people came by and said, oh, come over. We'll pick you up at night. and take you through the back door of the store? And they said, no. People sat down and organized things that I used to do. I wore my brother's pants so often. He was bigger than me. I was hating for that boy to grow. Of course, if he'd have stayed the same size, my mama might have bought me a new pair. But they shared what they had. If your child, if Oliver had outgrown something, we could pass it to somebody else in the family or somebody down the street. If you had a garden, you supplied some of the veggies that you grew to somebody else. These were folks that were on a mission. These were folks that were doing what they were doing for a reason, a cause, and they were not going to give it up. And they moved forward. 1963, fast forward. Before I got all together out there, Birmingham, Alabama, Medgar Evers was killed standing in his front yard. Birmingham, Alabama took place. And in Savannah, Georgia, the bus, the Freedom Riders had just passed Anniston, Alabama in 1961, May. They were beaten, testing the FCC law of interstate travel. All because they were black. We couldn't ride on a bus and go into the restroom at the bus station. You know, when you go and if you would see that, you saw 1, 2, 3. You got any idea how that number goes? Number 1, white women. Number 2, white men. Number 3, anybody and everything else that has to go. Don't complain because it wasn't clean, because it wasn't going to be. You had to deal with what you dealt with. Man's inhumanity to man was real. It was live, and it flourished. These were conditions that would allow me, a little boy on Butler Street in Savannah, Georgia, to begin to feel like enough is enough. We could read the headlines. Those of you who know about Woolworth stores and Crest stores, there was a group of young men who went to North Carolina A&T University. And they sat down and made history. And then it just looked like the movement, if you think about that name, I don't know who coined it, but the movement was fluid. It took on a life. Things began to move from one city to the other. Lo and behold, it hit Savannah, Georgia. And we began to move and march and to demonstrate in such a way that we too wanted to go to the swimming pool, that in a city where taxes paid for, the newspapers covered stories of how great it was, but I couldn't go. Savannah, Georgia sits on the Atlantic Ocean. Little place called Tybee Island. I never knew where Tybee Island was because after we reached a certain point, we had no business in that area and were subject to arrest. But we got through, waded in that water on Tybee Island, singing that song, wade in the water, children. God's gonna trouble the water. And the troubling of the water didn't trouble us. It was something that was somewhat transformative. We went to jail off Tybee Island. And by the time I was 17, I'd been to jail 7 or 8 times, sometimes twice a day. The schools in North Carolina or the schools in Savannah, Georgia, were a part of a court order that said the legislation that was enacted in 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education, which declared separate but equal was no longer the law of the land, and that black folks should be able to go to school with white folks. 9 years after that, the schools in Savannah, Georgia, with another court order, decided to desegregate. But what did they do? We desegregated in the 12th grade. Who wants to take their children out of school in the 12th grade? I lost some of the best jobs I ever wanted because because I had to let my children get out of school. If they were in 11th or 12th grade, you know, that's a tough call, whether I move or whether I stay. And yet, when we began to take a look at that, I asked my mom, I said, do you think I might go to Groves High School? My mama said, well, what you want to do? I said, well, I'm thinking about it. My daddy said, you don't have long to think, but whatever you decide, we're going to support you. Now, that's that third child syndrome. Now, you know, third children have it. There's something special about third children. My other five siblings would have never changed schools in the 12th grade. Now, they might have done it another year, but not in the 12th grade. I was not the brightest bulb in the chandelier, but I was certainly headed up there to tackle any of them that were coming on. I went to Groves High School after being arrested on the day that I was announced to go to school. My picture appeared in the paper. I was a busboy in a downtown restaurant. I had a very prestigious job in that restaurant. I cleaned off dirty tables. And you know, I was fast and I was good. I could hold that pan of dirty dishes in one hand and with the other hand wipe it clean and move the salt down in one stroke. You know, and so I was proud of that. They encouraged me to do my homework, but for me to go to a school that had a higher rating than the one that I did, had newer books than the one that I did, they fired me. I picketed them that afternoon. And before nightfall, I was in jail again. And my dad just keeps coming to get me out of jail. But then they gave me 30 days or $100. And I told my daddy, we didn't have $100 to spare, so I'm going to do the 30 days. My mama told me, you're going to get out of jail tomorrow. And we upped that $100. But the kind of thing I just want you to know, that freedom ain't free. The thought of what we wanted to do and where we were going was paid for with a price. And I was willing to make that price. Much of what happened took place on the backs of many young people. And as that all took place, you know, these situations of going to jail were the kind of things that exacerbated the situation. Have you ever had something done to you that only gave you greater resolve to see it through? And here I am. I don't know where it came from or what brought it all about. But it gave me the ability to have something that allowed me to say, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Ain't gonna let a $100 fine turn me around. Ain't gonna jail me and let that turn me around. While they were saying that, the bodies of Swarney, Goodman, and Cheney were discovered in Pearl, Mississippi. What were they doing? The same thing that I began to set out to do working with Martin Luther King. I went on the Groves. I got out. They were right behind. And my first assignment was Grenada, Mississippi. And it was not a very fun place to go to. My second assignment was St. Augustine, Florida, along with Hosea Williams. We went down to the Munson Motor Inn in St. Augustine, Florida. For those of you who think that the beauty of St. Augustine, Florida is just so overwhelming, understand that it was one of the largest slave sales ports in the country. And they were looking for those who were not enslaved to slave them. We got into the pool at the Munson Motor Lodge, and it was almost like a chemistry lesson. The manager came out and started pouring acid in the pool. And what we know is that acid and water don't mix. I still was not the best swimmer, Mitch. But I tell you, my ability to get out of that pool with all of that acid, it was something to behold. And so I just say all of that to tell you what gave me strength and ability to begin to move on. God uses ordinary people. There was nothing special about me. And he uses ordinary people to do as he commands, because little becomes much when we place it in the master's hands. And now one of the things that I got being home, I went to church often, stayed in church about as long as the rabbi had y'all out there today. You know, he already told me, we did the morning study of the Torah. We did another study that afternoon. I said, this is right at home. This is all home. And then they fed you and you sung all afternoon. I say, wow, there ain't too much difference between where I come from and where he is. But that was the kind of thing that the church was. The church was a community for me. So my beliefs are deeply rooted in that kind of a community. And I believe that when I faced Jim Clark in Montgomery, Alabama, or Birmingham, Alabama, when they put the dogs out on us, or any of you workers in your yard this time of year and you've got a little hand blower and you are blowing leaves off your driveway, imagine a fire hose being blown at somebody, and the fire hose can do this. And the person jumps, the person moves, and we're sitting there singing, we shall not be moved. And that fire hose hits beneath you, and you bounce. About the time you bounce, one of the sheriffs jams you with a cattle prod. We're locked arm in arm, just sitting there. And as much as we tried to endure, when you are touched with a cattle paw and a fire hose, you move. There ain't no shame. It makes you move. But we were yet determined. We were yet determined that our goal was going to be achieved. There's some things, y'all. Freedom ain't free. Everything they did to us was designed to stop us from doing what was necessary to bring about change. You all saw the pictures of those dogs. You saw that fire hose, or what it's called, is a water cannon. Two men cannot hold that hose when it's turned up. It takes more than one, and sometimes more than two, to hold that fire hose at full force. It's the kind of thing that if that thing blows you and you're up against a wall, you don't move. And you continue to sing, we shall not be moved. While you're singing, you're wiping them tears from your eyes. Lord, let this day pass from me. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things to bring about change. And you have to know that there was a lot of things that are calls for you and give you opportunity to stick with it. I was talking, and it brought back a whole nother message for me. I was talking to S-I-V-A, Ziva, in Hebrew. I think that's right. See, I remember something. And you know, and what we were talking about was a fellow by the name of Bob Moses. It took me a minute to recall Bob Moses, because before I could recall Bob Moses, I have to go back and think about Fannie Lou Hamer. And Fannie Lou Hamer had a message. She said, my name is Fannie Lou Hamer from Roseville, Mississippi. I got a story to tell. When did she say that? 1963. At the National Democratic Party Convention, and they had a division of that, a delegation from Mississippi. And that was when the Mississippi Democratic Party, Black Convention, whatever their names were, and they disrupted that piece of the party's convention at that time. But we were talking about a guy by the name of Bob Moses, and Bob Moses was a guy who was an organizer, a force in his own right, and most of the people there were part of what was called SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which at one time was headed by John Lewis. So when you, and John Lewis, you know, you hear these names after they have, quote, arrived. John Lewis was also a freedom rider. So it was not unusual for a very young man who came out of college in Tennessee. Freedom riders were for the most part, between 18 and 21, young men, young women, who were so determined to be on those buses that they signed a pact and sent home a letter to their parents to let them know that I may not come back with this. We may die, but we're willing to go through it. I used to hear Martin Luther King say something, a man who has not found something for whence he's willing to die ain't fit to live. That was not something I repeated very often. You know, I did not want to die doing what I was doing. But I didn't think about that, and it didn't stop us from doing it. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and young people who were willing to make the sacrifice that was going to change the world. You know, for me, it's difficult to forget Bloody Sunday and what happened the first weekend in March. And Bloody Sunday was about a number of things. You have to remember that when you can picture what the world was like prior to Bloody Sunday, people could be beaten, lynched. They could be killed in all kinds of ways. And most of the world did not know and did not realize what was happening. When Bloody Sunday took place, somehow somebody slipped. And it became a part of the news of the day. And the world in real time saw what was happening. And it saw the number of people, young people, old people, any people, who were there being beaten, trampled by horses. Freedom ain't free, y'all. People who were chased back into the church, Brown's Chapel AME Church, horses that climbed those steps to go after them, and some that were there. It's hard to forget the beating John Lewis took. It was hard to forget the beating that was taken by Amelia Boynton. It's hard to forget that Jose Williams took a beating himself. It was hard to commit to forget some of the ladies that we met along the way who were also beating, but seemed like they were insignificant. Now their stories resonate, and we now know who they are. They paid a price, and they had that determination. Let me back up just a second for you. You have to remember Martin Luther King at the time Rosa Parks sat down. Rosa Parks sat down. Martin Luther King was a new young preacher. And Martin Luther King was 26 years old. And in the black community, Martin Luther King's daddy, Rabbi, was a preacher's preacher. He could bring it. Martin Luther King was faced with that image of his daddy, but he was a new pastor. And he got that job because they did not want Vernon Jones, who was a rabble-rouser, who brought the word. And all I want you to begin to imagine is the number of young people who brought about such a change in this country. An ordinary man, he was not the Martin Luther King that we know today, but he did have the ability to speak and to talk. And from that, the rise of Martin Luther King took place. Somebody asked me, did I ever think that I would be where I am? Where am I? You know, I didn't put myself in that spot. But one of the things that I'll share with you, I have a younger brother. My brother's name was Earl. And Earl worked for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. But Earl was behind me, and I broke the ice with Mama and Daddy on what they might allow us to do. My older brother, you know how them first children are. They get away with murder, the first one and the last one. And my brother Richard, he was a math and physics major. You know, I was trying hard to get a degree in sociology. You know, I couldn't even beat the draft with that degree. And so the kind of thing that I say that for is that I've got a very ordinary kind of family. My brother got a scholarship to go to Morehouse. The first three of us were in college at the same time. My daddy didn't have it like that. The word was, you're going to either get a scholarship or you're going to have to go to school at home. There was nobody talking about going off. And so as I went off and was trying to go to college and I was trying to work for SCLC, and I'm just battling between the two, all along Earl joins what's called the NAACP Youth Council. And at 14, he became the head of the Youth Council. His career with the NAACP spanned from that position to becoming the head of the NAACP on an interim basis, where he was the one that sort of turned it around and the voter registration pieces of it. And my other brother became the head of the local branch of the NAACP. And my other sister, you know, I didn't realize that we had done so much in this fight for freedom until we sat down and started talking about from whence we had come. Freedom ain't free. But freedom is one of those things that we wanted to do and had such a penchant for trying to make it happen. I didn't know whether our house would be bombed. I didn't know whether my daddy would lose his job. I didn't know what might happen. But I knew that there were people who died for the rights that I was fighting for. That Viola Lee was a woman who traveled along the 50-mile stretch of Highway 50 in Montgomery, Alabama, a white woman who was killed. Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was killed in Marion, Alabama, trying to defend his grandmother. We had the Reverend James Reeb, a Unitarian minister. And then we look around and say that this was a black thing. Absolutely not. People of goodwill joined together to see what kind of things needed to be done, and they joined in that fight to happen. You know, and when we look at that and we start gathering in even more fuel for the fire that was within us, we found a way that we were going to be able to move forward, to go forward and to do more. You know, Martin Luther King, well, before Martin Luther King, John Kennedy was killed. And Martin Luther King, then you had Malcolm X killed. And you know, and all in their own right, it was tied to things around this thing elusively called freedom. You know, I had a problem. I'm sitting here and I had this ideal of what I wanted. And we sang a song, "Oh Freedom." Oh freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. I used to hear him say, you could sing a lie as well as to tell a lie. But for me, it took on that meaning. I sang that song with a new belief, with a new urgency of the moment. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me, and before I'd be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. I don't sing it the same way. I didn't mean to be disrespectful as we sung. When I sing songs with the conviction of where I was when I first heard that song. And I look at you when you sing some of the songs that you sing, and I know that you feel what that song is all about and that drive, and that's one of those things that moved me. I did not take very much thought of what might happen, but I took a whole lot of thought that I was not going to give up. You know, when we look at the gangs of the 60s,
you see the resonation of those things today. I want to tie almost a result of Bloody Sunday to the election of Bill Clinton, the first black president. Black people put Bill Clinton in office for whatever good it did. I'm not arguing the point. But we turned out in numbers like never before. And then we had this belief, the audacity of this hope that we could have an official black president with the election of Barack Obama. And as we began to look around all across the black belt of Alabama, where black belt people out, black people outnumbered white people 3-4 to 1, but nobody could ever get elected to office in Alabama and Mississippi. Soon after that, offices were again filled by black people. You know there were a whole lot of black people elected after Reconstruction. I mean, there are Harmon Reeves and others that were elected to the Senate and the House, and then somebody woke up and said, oh, he black. After that, it was all over with, and it did not happen. I was talking to somebody earlier, and forgive me if I said it already before, but the whole thing of Field Order 15, Sherman didn't burn down Atlanta. But when he got to Savannah, he talked about what we ought to do that was going to be meaningful to help black people overcome the situations that they were in. And as he talked to a large group of black ministers, they wanted land and the ability to become self-sufficient. 40 acres and a mule was born. And soon after that, they killed Abraham Lincoln and got another president. What was his first action? The repeal of Field Order 15. And ever since then, black folks have been trying to get reparations. You know, and so if you look at what we did of our own volition, there was nobody who decided to give people in Tulsa anything back for the burning down of Tulsa and its Black Wall Street. In Mobile, Alabama, in Rosewood, gave nothing back. All they did is took it away. Then we take a look at sundown cities where you had to be out of town, and those people who owned land in those places were displaced from that. You hear these fancy words like disenfranchisement. Now we listen to gentrification, and we talk about what kind of things have taken place. Freedom ain't free. But there's still hope in all of this. In the elections of last week, here in California, Prop 50, Trump hadn't done his part to keep... If he hadn't done his part to keep the nation in peril when so many people were ticked off by all of the things that are being missed, I hope I can get out of here Monday and so that, that these air traffic folks can go back to work. You know, and there's going to be somebody. I truly don't want anything to happen in the air now, you know. I hope they give them something. But I was understanding I was fine, so I'm not sure about this. But he decided not to pay off or extend payment for SNAP. I mean, you know, there are people who are hungry and hurting. And I don't understand, why would we be in a country where those people who make the laws are forbidden by law not to take their paychecks? I have never heard of such a thing. I didn't know that. But the Congress and the Senate has to be paid. And all of these other people who feel the pain. You know, once you turn past 65, thank God I am not totally in here. But, you know, I want to think that I put a little money in Social Security. I don't depend on it, but I didn't mean to leave it there. You know, and as I get older and a little less healthy, I don't want Medicare to jump up. They wouldn't let me pay for it at 60, after 65. I couldn't pay for it. I turned 65. My MCA told me I had to go on Medicare as my primary, and I paid them to be my secondary at that time. All I'm talking about is how government happens, and then this was an extension of what we may be able to do with the power of the ballot. I don't want to get into talking politics. I do want to get into talk about the power of the vote. When we look at the governor's election in Virginia, and then we look at the governor election in New Jersey, two women. I mean, and they were up against opposition that was pretty strong. And so here we have it. Who would have thunk it? Prop 50 didn't come up 6 months ago. That was not a whole lot of things. But the sign of the time was what the trouble was in the nation. That's my analysis of it. And here you got Prop 50. And now we're going to look for other cities and other states that are going to be able to do gerrymandering of the vote to go back. And we're going to mess around here after a while, and we're going to have a civil war in the voting booth of who got the most people and who don't. When will the government and our governing bodies begin to govern and begin to see the needs of the people rather than the needs of the party and come back and deliver us? I'm suggesting that we still need to vote. But many of us have believed that black people have arrived. And those black folks who have that as a real vision are living with something of an illusion of inclusion. We're still not all that. There's still things that move us back. We got to take another look at our mental outlook and see what the demands are now and how we begin to do something. You know the story of Rumpelstiltskin and how Rumpelstiltskin went to sleep and slept through the revolution. My hope isn't that you all will begin to take a look at what's taking place in this country today and not sleep through this revolution and find a way to stay woke. We need to have some voters registered. We got to get more people to the schools. We got to go back and reclaim our cities. As I sat here and I thought about the dreaming around being in California, and I hear about the east side and the west side, what's happening in one or the other, it sounds just like any other city anyplace else. We've got issues. How do we begin to talk about each other? One of the things that will happen is when expensive land gets too much to pay for, and the land across the bridge is available and is cheaper, somebody going to move in with eminent domain and take it over from whomever stays there. And in a large extent, we know who the culprit is. It's happened all across this country and where we began not to think much. Certainly, we've got to do something about crime. At this point in time, I usually roll up a $20 bill, step on that $20 bill, and I'd use that $20 bill and just walk on it and twist it and ask the question, who wants $20? I know this is a crowd that I need to use a larger bill. That's why I didn't use that exercise. But imagine this, a dirty $50 bill is worth $50. A broken or a displaced or misplaced young man or young woman still has value. And some way we've got to find a way to go back and reprieve and bring them back to where they see that they have hope to become a part of this great society. Somebody got to do something. In the words of Martin Luther King, we need a few more drum majors. We need some drum majors who are going to be willing to go out to the front to begin to take the lead and come back and again say, enough is enough. Don't believe that the problems of racial injustice will work themselves out. People of goodwill must join together and find solutions. And it's always right to do what's right because we are bound together in a vast world of humanity. What affects one of us directly affects another indirectly. I hope that that's going to be a day that we can join together and sing the words of a song, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I say. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. I'm grateful that you allowed me to spend this moment with you. And if I had a song to sing, I would do and bring forth Carol Burnett. I'm so glad we had this time together. Peace and power. since I pulled it, since I have it here, pull me up. I just told y'all about me to, I didn't tell y'all about me after I got old.
Coming.
But I want to just share one of my reasons for being, this was something I had that I was going to share with you. And it was, this was 1963, 64, but it says it's going to take some time for us to do those things that we wanted to do. And it is going to take time to do that. And I use this one because I want to let you know what my driving impetus is all about. This is my brood. These are my children. On this side, that's the newest member of my family. He's 6 months old. And that's my boy on the other side there. That's my grandson, my great-grandson, Liam. I don't know, that's a selfie you can tell. That's my daughter, my oldest daughter in the front there. But that's what drives me. Because I dream a world that they're not going to be governed by the color of their skin. My job is to help them develop the kind of character that will take them wherever they want to go. And again, I believe I can fly. Thank you. They're going to talk, but I want to tell you all this so you'll know. We're going to sing a song. The only thing I invite you to do, the words, Kevin, are going to be on the screen. And, oh, she got it. But the only thing I want you to do, sing this song with a little conviction. As you sing this song, cross your arms so that your heart's covered and exposed at the same time. And you know, when we were doing one of those lessons with the rabbi today, one of those verses is, that's something else. I didn't know that was Hebrew for we shall overcome. But it was the same tune, but it was there. So please, let's sing. Join together. Oh, sorry about that. Okay. Kevin.
Mike. Thank you.
So we'll end with the song, ending with hope, ending with connection, interconnection, to know that we're all doing this together. And this program, this evening, this whole day, could not have been possible without the helping hands of so many, from the committee, from Sergic, Danielle, and your team at Spark, and Eitz Chaim, all the volunteers that helped with the dinner, Havdalah, programming earlier for the kids. And all of this is thanks to you, George.
Thank you.
For, again, being our guiding light on the trip, and bringing that light to our communities, and for each of you, for bringing your light, and we take that light with us as we join our voices together. We shall overcome.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall. Thank you so much.
Thank you, George.